You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the past 50 years, Western countries have given $2.3 trillion in aid to poor countries, and yet that doesn't seem to have made much of a dent in the levels of poverty and disease around the world. William Easterly thinks he knows why, and he's called his new book from the Penguin Press, The White Man's Burden, Why the West's Efforts to Aid the Rest Have Done So Much Ill and So Little Good. William Easterly is a professor at New York University and a fellow at the Center for Global Development. He worked as an economist for the World Bank for over 15 years, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Professor Easterly to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Good to be here.
So what kind of aid are we talking about? Humanitarian aid? Aid for development?
Everything. The $2.3 trillion includes all types of aid, both humanitarian and to promote economic growth.
And how are most of our aid programs run today?
They're run through large multilateral organizations like the World Bank, or they're run through national aid agencies like USAID in the U.S.
I can understand why they're often ineffective, but your title suggests that aid efforts can actually do harm.
Well, I think the current aid discussion that we see now is doing a lot of harm because it really gives the appearance of action to help the world's poor, which substitutes for actual effective actions on the ground that would help poor people.
So how do we judge the effectiveness of an aid program?
You know, it's not that difficult when you concentrate on very specific, tangible tasks. Like, you know, for example, 2 million babies die every year from diarrheal diseases. And they die for the simple lack of 10-cent medicines, 10-cent oral rehydration therapy kits that would save their lives.
So we're talking about $2.3 trillion, none of that went into those kits?
It did go into those kits, but nobody was held accountable for the results, so that when the babies died, there's no one to point a finger at. You know, the aid system seems to be ingeniously designed that no one is to blame when things don't work.
Well, who do we wind up giving all the responsibility to? The locals, or is that something that we do and just don't do well?
Well, you have to start with the aid agencies themselves, like the World Bank and USAID. They should be held accountable for specific tasks, like getting 10-cent medicines to babies with diarrhea. And when they don't deliver, then they should be exposed as a failure.
Well, you worked for the World Bank for over 15 years.
Yeah.
What was happening there? Were you one of those frustrated people, or did it take you leaving the World Bank to realize why everything had gone wrong?
Well, I was a fairly slow learner, but I was gradually, over the years, getting more and more disillusioned with what the results of our programs were to achieve economic growth in the poor countries, to achieve results for poor people. And this book is kind of the culmination of 21 years working on economic development and the sorrow and the anger that I feel that so little of it has really changed the lives of poor people.
Well, at the World Bank, because you were there, wasn't anyone held accountable when a program that was supposed to cure some problem didn't?
Well, Leonard, you know, the shocking answer is no. They aren't.
Nobody ever got fired. You know,
we put
$1 billion into, well, not a billion, but many millions of dollars into curing this problem, and nothing has happened, and nobody gets fired?
Leonard, there isn't even the attempt to measure the impact of what the World Bank is doing. That shows you how far we are away from a system of incentives where somebody could get held accountable and fired for not getting results.
And yet the World Bank holds governments accountable for some of their actions, don't they?
Yeah,
they withhold aid if governments don't do certain things.
Right, you're right. It's amazing. And in fact, they give governments advice on how to, you know, try to motivate their own employees to get results by devising systems of incentives and, you know, rewarding results. But the World Bank doesn't do the same thing to its own staff.
There are any number of critics throughout the Third World of the World Bank.
Yeah.
Blame the World Bank for the problems of their countries. Does that ever come back to the people at the World Bank? Do they ever say, maybe this criticism has some legitimacy?
What I see happening in response to those criticisms is they adjust public relations so that, you know, the image of the bank is better. So there were these things called structural adjustment loans, which were these conditional loans imposed on poor countries that they had to essentially sort of switch to free markets overnight, which is a program that never works anywhere in return for getting the loan. These loans have been failing ever since they were started in 1980, and then waves of criticism coming back from the poor countries. And do you know what the World Bank's response was? They changed the name of the loan. Now it's called a poverty reduction and support credit instead of a structural adjustment loan.
My guest is William Easterly. His book, The White Man's Burden, Why the West's Efforts to Aid the Rest Have Done So Much Ill and So Little Good. It's published by the Penguin Press. So the part of the whole thing is a Western idea that the world is a better place if everybody works in a free market system?
Well,
is that the key here, or is that just one of the problems that we see from the IMF and the World Bank?
You know, there's nothing wrong with the prescription of free markets in general as a long-run prescription, because that is how people get rich in the long run. There's no doubt about that. The problem is that implementing a free market takes tons of local knowledge that the World Bank and the IMF don't have. And when they try to impose these free markets on poor countries, they often just botch the job terribly.
In some cases, doesn't it also go against the traditions of a culture?
Sure.
Where, for example, there are any number of cultures that could be called socialist, although that's not the word they would use. It would just be the tribal tradition. And to come in and say you have to change would really be a shock to the whole system.
Right. I mean, a part of the problem is that we in the West underestimate the complexity of what sounds simple, like property rights, like owning a piece of land. You know, often there's a very rich tradition of who has claims to that land in local cultures. In Africa, for example, there'll be overlapping claims. Everyone within the family will have some claim at some time of year, some to graze on the land, some to farm the land for crops. And then if the World Bank comes in and says, well, now you have to have a piece of paper saying who owns the land 100%, that doesn't mesh well with local cultures, and it doesn't work. It's not effective.
So whether it's the United States, Britain, or one of the Scandinavian countries giving the aid, it turns out all the same way?
There have been lots of tests by researchers whether there's some kind of aid that works. And so far we haven't found one, I'm sad to say.
But you say some developed countries run better aid programs than others.
Yeah, I think, Great Britain has the Department for International Development, which seems to be a little better at measuring results and insisting on results. USAID, the USAID agency, is actually one of the worst in many respects, because it concentrates a lot of effort on giving favors to U.S. companies and consultants when it gives aid.
And is that something that has happened in a nonpartisan way over the years? Or do some administrations pressure more than others?
It's been a constant throughout the years. They feel like they have to justify foreign aid by awarding the contracts to U.S. companies, basically, in both parties.
You say Japan has a better program. And is it Singapore?
Singapore has a great program for itself.
An authoritarian state.
Certainly not a democracy, but they, we're the epitome of free trade. They were a free trade entrepot ever since the 19th century, where Chinese merchants settled there voluntarily and were free to relocate if the government was not promoting free markets, and so they became sort of a free trade success story.
Mm-hmm. But what about Japan? Does Japan, as a country that has had a dual experience, have more insight into how this works?
I don't think it makes Japanese aid any more effective, but Japan itself is kind of an inspirational story as a non-Western country that achieved democracy and prosperity through totally homegrown efforts without the assistance of the arrogant Westerner who thinks that he's the savior of the rest of the world.
Is it just free market economies, or is there also an implication that democracy has to be part of
democracy? Democracy is very important because it's, you know, you, it's true that you can get the odd Singapore where you have a benevolent autocrat, but most of the autocrats are not benevolent. They're more like Mobutu, who steal millions, billions.
So
democracy guarantees you that you will be accountable to the people.
Well, but what does democracy mean? Are we when America gives aid, when America talks about democratizing the Middle East, for example, is it talking about American-style democracy? Because right now in Iraq, there seems to be, there's a debate all over as to what kind of democracy we're going to see in Iraq and whether it's the kind of democracy George Bush envisioned when we invaded the country in the first place.
Well, imposing democracy by force against the will of the local inhabitants is a contradiction in terms. And that explains a lot of the disaster in Iraq. You know, the idea that we can democratize the rest of the world is just arrogant hubris. A democracy really has to be a homegrown thing, but coming from local political reformers.
What happens when a group like the Peace Corps goes into a country and spreads the notion of American-style democracy? Is that received well? Because we're just talking about a one-on-one kind of thing. Perhaps that's better than aid coming in from on high.
Yeah, the groups like the Peace Corps and like the non-governmental volunteer organizations that have people in the field, they at least are very close to the people and form long-term relationships with the people and get better results by knowing much better what's going on the ground.
So the NGOs are the preferable way to give all of this foreign aid. When we say $2.3 trillion over the last 50 years, we're talking about NGOs as well as governmental
groups. No,
that's
just official aid, although some NGOs will get contracts from official aid to deliver it.
Oh, so there's been a lot more than $2.3 trillion.
So you can add to that all the private donations, which are quite substantial.
Probably have to be in the trillions as well, or then somewhere up there.
No one has really systematically measured them, but they're very large, yeah.
So let's take a little break, and when we come back, I'd like to know how you think we should approach aid programs. How should we conceive them if we were starting from the ground up? My guest is William Easterly, who is a professor of economics at New York University, a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development, was a research economist at the World Bank for over 16 years. He has written for The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, Forbes, and Foreign Policy, and is the author of The Elusive Quest for Growth, Economists' Adventures and Misadventures in the Tropics. Now, The White Man's Burden, Why the West's Efforts to Aid the Rest Have Done So Much Ill and So Little Good. It is published by the Penguin Press. Stay with us. We're back with William Easterly, whose book is called The White Man's Burden, Why the West's Efforts to Aid the Rest Have Done So Much Ill and So Little Good. It is published by the Penguin Press. I wasn't alone in being a bit surprised by the tone of this book. Your CV would have led me and a number of the reviewers to think of you as something of a policy wonk, and this book sounds very much like an impassioned polemic.
Yeah, it is a polemic. I admit that. It really represents the building up of frustration, anger, sorrow, that so much effort has gone in over 50 years to trying to have aid money help the poor. And so little has been accomplished. And instead, we just see the same old failed ideas being recycled over and over again.
So how should we approach aid programs instead? How should we conceive them if we're starting from the beginning?
Well, everything really starts with accountability. That, you know, the problem in aid has been that the poor people who are not getting the benefits have no ability to complain. You know, there was no sort of outcry when the 2 million babies died because they did not get oral rehydration therapy kits. You know, there was nothing comparable to the wave of outrage that followed Hurricane Katrina when the government screwed up domestically in the U.S. Well, there have been, you know, dozens of Katrinas in the poor countries, And there has been no outcry. And what I would like to see, and that's what accounts for the polemics, is I'd like to see an outcry. I'd like to see a campaign to hold these guys' feet to the fire to really get results so that money reaches the poor.
Well, when you say these guys, are you talking about the people administering these aid programs, or are you talking about the people on the other side? Because often when this sort of thing comes up, people simply say, well, you know, we can do what we can do, but then we have to deal with the corruption in these countries. All of the warlords or the dictators or the corrupt politicians or whomever skimming their part off the top, and it never seems to reach the people who need it most.
Well, that's just an evasion of responsibility. I mean, corruption is certainly a real, very real problem and does account for a lot of the poverty that the poor countries have. But the aid agencies, you know, are set up to get results for the world's poor. If they're dealing with a corrupt government, then what they have to do is bypass that government and have medicines reach the poor directly. It's not rocket science.
You said that there isn't enough of an outcry, but aren't things like Live 8, led by Bono and Angelina Jolie and the like, raising the profile of suffering in Africa?
Well, I think that the Live 8 is great, that it does raise the profile of the need. Unfortunately, the main thing it seems to lead to as far as action is a concentration on how much aid money is being spent. So the reflexive response is we need to double the amount of aid to Africa. But that's the amount of aid money we spend is not how you measure success. You know, you don't measure the success of a movie by what its production budget was. You know, you measure it by whether you like the movie or not. Unfortunately, the rich people who pay for aid never see the movie that results from their aid dollars.
And actually, the people who would like to see an increase, like the protesters after the most recent conference, are the ones who just want to see more money sent without any thought about how it is actually spent. So you distinguish between planners and searchers.
Right.
This is the way you see the problem being resolved?
Yeah. The planners are the ones who announce the grandiose symbolic goals of ending world poverty, but they don't allow themselves to be held accountable. They just come up with grandiose plans with hundreds of interventions, none of which are monitored systematically for whether they're working or not. Nobody is going to be held individually responsible for whether they work or not.
That, in other words, the World Bank, which is
the World Bank, the United Nations, the whole Jeffrey Sachs approach to development, all of that is a planning approach where you just decide in Washington and New York what should be done, and then you send off the money and the packets of medicines, and you never hear back whether they got results or not.
I wonder why the United Nations is in that group. After all, it's made up of the countries in need. You would have thought that somebody would have come up with a better plan.
Well, it's made up of the governments of the countries in need. The governments are perfectly happy to sign off on plans that allow those governments getting more money because, as we discussed, they're often corrupt and don't really care themselves about their own poor people.
So you say that the planner approach doesn't work, no matter who's coming up with the plan. It's often imposed.
Right.
And
right.
It often and almost always never gets to the people in need.
Right.
The alternative is the searchers. What are the searchers?
So the searchers are people who don't offer grandiose plans like to end world poverty. They just say, you know, let's find a specific intervention that will help poor people, like to go back to the example we were talking about before, oral rehydration therapy to save the lives of babies with diarrheal diseases. We're just going to find ways that we can get that working. And, you know, some specific aid agency is going to be responsible for that. And they're going to be held, you know, if they make that program a success, they'll be rewarded with more aid money to expand the program. And if they fail, then the program will be given to somebody else who can make it work.
Have you read the book, The Economic Hitman?
Yes.
Do you agree with him? Because he was criticized a lot for suggesting that we get these countries hooked on development projects that they then can't pay for.
Right. No, I don't agree with him. I think that's a sort of conspiracy theory view of what went so badly wrong. the people I knew at the managers that I knew in the World Bank and the other aid agencies were not intelligent enough to organize a worldwide conspiracy to screw the poor countries.
Wow, they're happy to hear you say that. That's a really backhanded compliment, but it also suggests that there is idealism. There is a desire to do well, even though they really have no idea how to do it.
Yeah, I think it's really incompetence. It's not malevolence.
Mm-hmm. Actually, the book is what? Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Right.
You said that planner programs don't work, but didn't they work in Eastern Europe in the early 1990s, at least in some countries?
Well, the transition to free markets, worked better where countries had a tradition of free markets already and were very eager to adopt free markets on their own and adapt them to local conditions on their own. Where they were a disastrous failure was in the former Soviet Union, where people with no knowledge of Russian history just went in and, just said, let's have free markets, let's privatize everything. They didn't have controls on even on, looting, so that, all the privatized companies just got stolen by the oligarchs. And now there's this big backlash against free markets.
So it works better in countries that had a tradition of capitalism, like Czech Republic and Poland, but not well in a country where it never was. There's no institutional memory.
Correct. And that's why it's so important to know what the conditions are on the ground to get feedback and then be held accountable for listening to that feedback or whether something's likely to work.
One of the aspects, first of all, let me tell everyone who I'm talking to. My guest is William Easterly, who is a professor of economics at NYU. His latest book, The White Man's Burden, Why the West's Efforts to Aid the Rest Have Done So Much Ill and So Little Good. It is published by the Penguin Press. And this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Is it possible to bypass corrupt governments if they don't want you to? If they say, I want my little piece of the action, whether you're giving people drugs or mosquito nets or whatever, aren't they going to get it?
Well, certainly there are some countries that will just refuse to let the Western agencies get involved at all, and there's no hope there. There's no hope in Belarus. But otherwise, I think you can embarrass governments into saying, let's work directly with private social entrepreneurs who are doing good things on their own. In Ghana, there is a new university that has been started by a Ghanaian expatriate who became a Microsoft millionaire, went back to Ghana and started a university that's called the Swarthmore of Ghana, a Shesi university. And amazingly enough, he never got aid. He asked for aid and he was turned down. The aid agencies are more interested in designing their own programs to increase education, which is one of their big goals. But when, it seems like, everyone is invited to the game of saving Africa except for the Africans. When an African reformer finds a solution on the ground, the aid agencies don't reward him.
We saw the same thing recently with a guest who started schools mostly for girls in Pakistan and Afghanistan, in areas that had been sympathetic to the Taliban or been controlled by the Taliban. And they have been great successes. And he has never received a penny from the U.S. government. All the money he's received has been from people who made money, actually, again, in the dot-com boom and decided that they wanted to help somebody.
Right. And instead we see...
That was Greg Mortensen. I don't know if you've read his book, but it's quite fascinating.
Instead we see like a government like Cameroon that has had the same corrupt dictator for 25 years, getting 80% of its government revenue from aid.
Well, on the other hand, African leaders stress the need for Africans to help themselves.
Yes.
So is that a good idea? Are there ways of getting Africans to actually help themselves in a positive way without putting too many strings attached?
I think, again, if you are willing to work with not just the governments, but with, local people on the ground who are finding solutions that work. There's a program in Malawi to combat malaria that was found by the Malawian staff of a non-governmental organization called PSI, which is in Washington. And they came up with this clever scheme to just, instead of trying to work through the government health service in the usual way, they decided to pay the government nurses 9 cents for every bed net that they handed out to pregnant mothers, who are one of the primary risk groups for malaria. And this program has been very successful in increasing the rate of usage of nets by pregnant women in Malawi, and it's now being expanded to other countries.
You have also pointed out that in one program where people were asked to pay for the nets, it was much more effective than when they were just simply given away.
Yeah, when they're given away, first of all, it destroys the existing market, because there is a private sector market to supply nets for the market price, which is about $4 or $5 in Africa, and which not all people can afford, but some people can afford, and that covers part of the problem. The searcher model that they followed in Malawi was they charged the pregnant mothers 50 cents a net. And that was effective in sort of screening out the people who just wanted to use the nets for frivolous purposes, because in other free net distribution programs, we see a lot of nets being winding up being used as fishing nets or bridal veils, you know, fashion accessories. When you give something for free, you know, people don't take it seriously.
And if we could get more of those nets distributed in countries where malaria is a problem, how effective would that be?
It would be very effective. It's not a magic bullet that will solve the problem of malaria overnight, but it's part of a package that can be very effective, including, you know, also indoor spraying of houses. And again, that is something, a specific task that you could hold, you know, the World Health Organization accountable for, and if they get results, you give them more money to expand the program. If they don't, then you give the program to somebody else.
The election of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to be president of Liberia has been dealt with as a very hopeful sign. She was educated in the West and then came back to her home country. Do you see that as something that we could be optimistic about, or would the fact that she was educated in the West automatically lead her to think in this top-down way that you're so critical of?
No, I don't think it makes her think in a top-down way. I think, obviously the West has a lot of technology and good ideas to offer for very poor countries. And so, you know, the local leaders who voluntarily of their own initiative go and get educated because they think the West has some good things to offer, and then come back and make things happen on the ground and make things happen through government, as in the case of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, that's a very hopeful sign, and that's starting to happen more and more. There's a new generation of African leaders, both political leaders and business leaders, that is being educated in the West.
Unless the aid money is shipped right away into Swiss banks, wouldn't it still have some kind of a positive effect, because an infusion of money automatically stimulates an economy, doesn't it?
Yeah, it stimulates an economy, but it could do a lot more good if we were actually having the aid do what it was supposed to do, getting, you know, people protected from malaria with bed nets rather than just paying the salaries of government bureaucrats who are unmotivated.
And why are you so critical of Jeffrey Sachs's proposals to help Africa? He seems to make real sense.
Jeffrey Sachs, you know, I really admire his compassion and his charisma and the profile that he has given to Africa. But he seems to have this sort of utopian vision that if you just come up with a comprehensive plan, I counted in one of his reports, 449 separate actions that we should all take to fix Africa. There's something in that to me that smacks of hubris and arrogance that we know how to fix the problems. And he's also always saying that the answer is more aid money. You know, if the $2.3 trillion has not achieved results so far, then why is funneling more money into the same failed system going to help?
And that's the white man's burden that you are talking about in your title. I know,
yes.
You took it from Rudyard Kipling,
yes,
who saw,
yes,
it in a different way,
yes,
than,
yes,
than you see the white man's,
yes,
burden.
Yes, Bono, the rock star, wrote the introduction to Jeff Sachs's book, and he had this line that it's up to us. You know, and that, I think, is incredible arrogance to say that it's up to us. It's not up to rich white people to save Africa. It's up to Africans. But
we'd still have to send the money. You're just saying we should do it in a different way.
Yes, I think until homegrown local democracy and free markets bring Africa to a higher level of prosperity, I think there's a lot of suffering that can be alleviated by rich white people. But I don't think it's up to us to achieve the long-run prosperity of Africa. I think Africans are very self-reliant.
Many attribute the rise of Islamic terrorism to the underdeveloped economies with high unemployment rates throughout the Middle East and other parts of the world. Does foreign aid take on greater significance because of the threat of terrorism?
Well, the threat of terrorism has made us all much more aware of how the world is interconnected and that it's dangerous to have large impoverished areas of the world, which could be breeding grounds for terrorism. But it doesn't give you any insights into how to fix those problems. Fixing the problems, again, requires incentives, feedback, accountability, not the arrogance of the white man's burden.
The Wall Street Journal review ended with Mr. Easterly's response to Darfur might well be do nothing action is worse than inaction. And then they say after the review says after reading your book, he fears that you may be right. But inaction really in Darfur?
I didn't say that.
I know. He's saying it might well be.
Might well be, yeah. You know, Darfur is an interesting very sad example of how previous incarnations of the white man's burden have led to disaster. Darfur was a region that was just annexed to this hodgepodge that we call Sudan by the British colonizers. And part of the violence there reflects a long history of being marginalized by the powers that be in Sudan. But, if we gave up the sort of utopian hope of fixing Sudan altogether, then something specific like just rescuing women and children and men from being brutally victimized, killed, raped, that's feasible. And when you concentrate on specific tangible things and hold somebody accountable for getting it done, that's feasible.
William Easterly is a professor at New York University, a fellow at the Center for Global Development, who worked as an economist for the World Bank for 16 years or so. His latest book from Penguin Press is The White Man's Burden, Why the West's Efforts to Aid the Rest Have Done So Much Ill and So Little Good. Thank you so much for being with us
today. It's a pleasure.